present the News Quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome again to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the Cambrian News, read by Corrie Caulfield.
One-bedroom flat to let, £67 per wee, including water.
Thanks to Neil Barclay of Hexham for sending us that. Let's meet the teams now. Please welcome first on my right, Andy Hamilton and Jeremy Hardy. Opposite them on my left, Francis Ween and Tony Hawkes. Andy, to misquote Barry Manilow, who came and he took without giving.
Is this Peter Mandelson?
It is.
Right, well, this week has seen a lot of chaff in the press about Jeffrey Robinson's memoirs, and I think we've now got a very clear and believable picture of the conversation that Jeffrey Robinson had with Peter Mandelson about that loan. Basically, what happened was Jeffrey Robinson was having a dinner party, everyone's having a very good time, and he noticed Peter Mandelson sitting in the corner going, "Oh." And Jeffrey Robinson sidled over to him, obviously, and said, "What's the matter, Peter?" And he said, "Here I am, arguably the second most powerful man in the country, leading a glamorous life at the centre of power, and every night I go home to this pokey three-storey house in Clerkenwell, where there isn't even room to swing a Brazilian. And it just depresses me, and I have this dream of a bigger house in somewhere like Notting Hill, for example. But alas, I know that must just remain a dream." And Jeffrey said, "Now you wipe those tears, my lad." "Because it just so happens, by an extraordinary coincidence, that I am a wealthy millionaire." And Mandelson said, "You're joking. What are the odds against that?" And by this very subtle dialogue, they reached an understanding. And, of course, it's terribly important whether Mandelson asked Robinson for the loan rather than the sort of inconsequential question of him having the loan and trying to keep totally quiet about it, which some people could think was a more important issue, really. But now we know the truth, which is good.
What is weird, though, this blind trust thing. Jeffrey Robinson claims to have put money into Blair's blind trust, but I don't understand these blind trusts, because if you're anonymous, then how do you get a peerage or get influence over government policy? That doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
I think it's all about moving in the right circles, because I was at a dinner party and I mentioned that I lived in a dark, dingy flat, and my mate didn't offer me £373,000, he just came round with an angle poise lamp.
But you sort of feel sorry for Mandelson, because his worst offence, according to this Robinson book, was that he didn't invite Robinson to his housewarming party. That was what caused all the trouble.
Well, he just lent the money for the house. I mean, I wouldn't invite the Cheltenham and Gloucester to my housewarming party.
Also, there's the risk that if Robinson, you know, is a little bit short in the sensitivity department, he might have come round the flat going, "I pay for that and that. And that." All of this. This is me, all of this, everybody. Which might have been a bit embarrassing. Might have let the secret out.
Friends of Mr. Mandelson say he might have been better off to have camped out rather than taken the home loan. According to the former Paymaster General, it's vital that policy and personality feuds must be settled in private. So it's lucky he hasn't told anyone what he really feels about Peter Mandelson then. Jeremy, who's planning once again to make fuels out of the government?
This will be the hauliers, who've spent the last 30 years crashing through picket lines and scabbing, and the farmers who've spent the last 30 years eating our subsidies and poisoning us with cows fed on manky sheep guts and putting filth all over our fields and rivers and so forth, and getting subsidised fuel they don't pay any duty on anyway.
So 2 points to Jeremy.
being able to claim back all the VAT on fuel because they're self-employed. But nonetheless, you've got to feel a bit sorry for that, you know, because all indirect taxation is regressive and in principle wrong, and taxation should be direct, as we know. But nonetheless, Gordon Brown should really say, "Well, you know, unless you back down in your demands, I shall renationalise rail, make it safe and put all the freight back on it. In fact, that's such a good idea, I'm going to do it anyway."
to that country march. You're going to come down one morning, you won't be able to get your front door open because there'll be a big pile of manure there. Red Jeremy.
I suppose if it does start up again, we'll have to suffer all that panic buying that goes on. Although I'm not sure whether this is the right term, because I've watched these people queuing for the petrol, and they're not panicking at all. They're just sitting there very calmly indeed. Panic buying is going out to get petrol and coming back with curtains.
I've worked out the way to beat the blockades next time, which is to get the milkman to deliver pints of petrol. And it'd be a bit of a shock for the blue tits, but I think it'd be perfect. Just milkman, just leave a note.
I think if you start having petrol bombs brought to the house, you'll be getting visits from Special Branch quite quickly.
Fuel protesters met government ministers on Thursday to press their demands for a cut in fuel duty. The People's Fuel Lobby said that they should follow the example of the Countryside Alliance. Though how 15 articulated lorries chasing a fox across Kent will help their cause is anybody's guess.
Something occurred to me that's annoyed me. When the left do things and there's strikes and it's the unions, they always say that they were agitators from outside the area. And yet they have never accused the hauliers of being from outside the area. And yet clearly by definition they are from outside the area. They are permanently outside the area. So I just thought I should get that off my chest.
Tony
Hughes. And, you know, when it's the unions, the media's got a totally different approach. It's always more misery for commuters, never more joy for anarcho-syndicalists. I'm sorry, Simon, you were saying.
Tony Hughes' news look received a right royal reception.
The royal would be the royal family, wasn't it? And this is rather tedious business that's going on, the ratings war between BBC One and ITV. And basically what they're doing is just messing us around. So they just move the news every week. I don't know why. The idea being that you have to tune into them just not knowing what time the news is going to be on. You have to watch them all evening just to get some chance of watching it. They'll probably do random news, 8:48 news. And the BBC clearly feels so guilty about this, because I was watched one of the bulletins the other day, and they announce now all the different times you can see it. And they feel so guilty about the 9 o'clock news not being on anymore that they say you can watch a special 9 o'clock bulletin with Gavin Esler on BBC News 24. Well, it's 24 hours news. Obviously, it's going to be on at 9 o'clock, isn't it? It's annoying, it's irritating. And they were messing around with the scheduling as well. I think they made some of the programmes run too long. It's terribly, terribly devious. They're evil people at work.
Tony, you're just getting old and grumpy, I think. They keep changing the names of sweets. Oil of Olay. It's Oil of Olay. It's not even a sweet. What's going on? This was old fields when I was a girl.
Well, the most impressive thing is that on, I think, Fridays or Saturdays, they've now brought Have I Got News For You over from BBC Two to fill the 9 o'clock slot. So people turn on, and they see this programme called Have I Got News For You? To which the answer is, no, we haven't.
Francis, listen to this. Francis, who roamed far and wide for a wholly suitable audience.
Aha, uh-huh, it's Madonna's friend, Il Papa.
Oh, I thought you meant the Queen. Yes, yeah, yes it is.
Well, she was there too, yeah. Hmm. They met for the first time in about 20 years, I think. And they had one of those usual conversations, have you come far? All these things. So what are you doing now? Oh, still Pope, what are you doing? Still Queen? And so it went on.
He gave her a canaletto, didn't he? And I understand she already has quite a few canalettos. I'll put this with the others.
But they do this exchanging of gift things, and I think that the Queen shouldn't really give her present first, so she basically should take advantage of them, because she got a 13th century medieval Bible from the Pope as well, and I think she should say, thank you very much, and then just give him a fun-sized Mars bar back.
Why don't they do that thing of agreeing beforehand not to exchange presents, because it's just so expensive every year, isn't it?
When Andy said that he gave her a canaletto, I was thinking that Leto is some strong lager that I hadn't heard of. Everyone was kicking up because some mayor, she had to meet this mayor, and his wife, who's a journalist, couldn't be asked to go. And I thought, just because someone's a politician, why should his wife follow around like a moonstruck nitwit? I reckon. In fact, I think the blessed Cherie Booth is a successful woman, and she should just not be prepared to go along with, you know, when he says, oh, Cherie, the Clintons are down. He says, I don't care, I'm not coming down. I've got a big case to have. Gives me the creeps, that bloke. The whole marriage is such a sham. I can't, you know. I'm staying up here.
So, can I just ask our signer, please? What is the symbol for Bill Clinton? Can you just show us?
Oh, it's not. That was one of the great moments in radio history.
How surreal is this, everybody?
This was the meeting in Rome between a man who believes himself to be infallible, along with his wife, the Queen, and the Pope. As the Queen presented the Pope with his gifts, Buckingham Palace pointed out that the 50 Canaletto drawings were her idea, and the Father Ted Series 1 and 2 box set were Philip's. We start round two with an item seen in construction news.
Demolition experts are ridiculing a bill of £30 million to tear down the Millennium Dome. Chairman Tony Gregory said the safest and cheapest form of demolition would be to use a controlled implosion. The dome is an ideal position for such a method. There would be no need to remove the public.
Thanks to Bruno Porter of County Durham for spotting that. Andy, whose strike-breaking activities caused a lot of hurly-burly?
Liz Hurley. Liz Hurley made some ads for... Oh, this is fashion. Jeremy, help me. You know,
just say scab. I just want to say Liz Hurley's a scab. And even if I didn't know she was a scab, I'd want to call her out anyway. I think this is marvellous. Even if it's not true, I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, she's made... What is she famous for? She's upstaging her boyfriend with her frocks. And she's a scab, isn't she? She is a scab. Didn't she, Andy? Back me up here.
Has anyone suggested anger management glasses? If that's the story, she made an ad for some perfume or something.
Estee Lauder.
Estee Lauder.
Same thing.
Thank you, Fred. That's the man
Harry
of culture.
Water.
And she's saying she didn't know there was a strike and she didn't know it was a picket line. She said she thought they were fans with F words in there. Placards. And so she's now paid into the strike fund, I think, in an attempt to build bridges.
She is a waste of space, isn't she? She's the person that the expression tit for tat was made for. Mind you, it's a bit hard to get aerated and militant about actors being on strike over the money they get for voiceovers for adverts, isn't it, really?
The actual dispute is about the American broadcasting companies trying to buy out the actors' fees on ads so they'd only get paid once for doing an ad. And that would be important to American actors because in America, of course, the same ads go out millions of times. I spent a fortnight in America last year and I saw the same, do you suffer from gas? Ad about 20 times a day.
Gas is petrol in America, though, isn't it?
Oh, gas. Gas. Body gas. Personal gas.
And did you make any purchases when you were there? It would have been handy, in my experience of knowing you.
I suffer from terrible wind, and this is true, and I went to see my GP, and he said, you've got IBS. And I said, what's that? And he said, it's irritable bowel syndrome. And I thought, well... My car's got ABS, which must be amiable bowel syndrome.
It's not just your bowels that are irritable. All of you's irritable.
I've got irritable bastard syndrome.
Liz Hurley was barracked by pickets in Hollywood at the premiere of her latest film after breaking a strike called by the Screen Actors Guild, or SAG. Jeremy, listen to this. That was Shopping by the Pet Shop Boys, who's bagged themselves an environmental disaster.
Oh, bloody hell. This is another one of the government's efforts to make us all care more about the environment. And I'm sorry, I mean, I do care about the environment, but pardon me for washing myself and having the occasional cup of tea. I'm not some vast chemical corporation filling our seas with filth. I'm not Balfour Beatty, who the government is supporting in building a huge dam somewhere where a dam's not needed, which is going to flood archaeological treasures and make people homeless. Pardon me. Yeah. I'm not NATO's turn the Danube into a toxic soup. And yet the government comes on the news and says, are you doing your bit? Why aren't you having your bath in a plastic carrier bag? Why not use both sides of lavatory paper? And instead of using plastic bags to line your pedal bin, simply pull one over your head and then you'll breathe in and die and then you won't use up any more air. In a year, you use enough air to fill up enough balloons to fill up a whole bath the same size as a Millennium Dome. Instead of making a cup of tea, why don't you just stuff all your plastic bags into your kettle and that'll cause a fire and kill your whole family. You won't then eat any food or walk on the pavement and wear it out by being individual.
You're frightening
I'm
me now.
I'm fed up with all of that.
I'm afraid that's the wrong answer. just having you on there, Jeremy.
Plastic bags, isn't it? We're told we're not allowed to have plastic bags anymore. We've got to put our shopping in our pockets, which is a good idea. It's called stealing. So there you go. So that's the message. Thief.
Yes, it's a shocking...
2 points.
It's a shocking discovery that UK consumers use 8 billion carrier bags a year. There are concerns that plastic bags filled with rotting food could spread diseases. One health inspector said that at least 2 out of 3 bags could be carriers. Tony, he was told that perhaps he shouldn't have had a white wedding.
Prince Charles was told this by the, I think, Lady Gavron from the Runnymede Trust, which is allegedly a left-wing think tank, where they all get together in a tank and think. And think, why did we arrange to do this in a tank? Large office would have been better. And they came up with the theory that Prince Charles perhaps should have been told to marry a black woman, because it would have given off the right messages to the people. But I don't quite know how he would have gone about courting this woman without it looking like tokenism, because he would look quite conspicuous on some of the dance floors of some of the clubs in Brixton, I think, really. And I don't know whether he would have survived the dancing part of the whole courtship anyway, because I saw him dancing in about 1974 with the Three Degrees, and he got up on stage and did this dance with them called the Bump, and 2 of the Degrees never walked again.
Gavron's a funny name. That's not a name, is it? It's an artificial fabric.
Polls show that a surprising number of Britons do agree with Lady Gavron that Prince Charles should indeed consider marrying a black woman, because it would be worth it to see the look on Prince Philip's face. Andy, who finally solved an enigma wrapped up in a bubble wrap?
Well, this was this rather spooky story that the Enigma decoding machine, which was stolen a while back from Bletchley, turned up. It was sent to Jeremy Paxman at Newsnight. And sadly, and perhaps shamefully, Jeremy Paxman did not interrogate himself on air about how it came to be in his possession. But presumably, a decoding machine would be quite useful, because he might have it out next time he's interviewing Prescott. He'll just kind of tap it in as he goes. And the machine was returned, but not with the rotors, which make it work. And there was apparently a note from somebody calling himself the Master. So there's a very sad person out there, probably a Doctor Who fan, who thinks it's funny to muck Jeremy Paxman about.
I wonder if there's any truth in this at all. It's just Jeremy Paxman made this up to cover the fact that he just hasn't mastered online shopping. He was trying to get a couple of Simply Red CDs.
It's a great shame the police didn't pull him in for receiving stolen goods, which he clearly has. So you can imagine, you could sell tickets to the interrogation. Put it on pay-per-view. Policeman at last giving Paxman a taste of his own medicine. All right, Mr. Paxman, I'm going to ask this question 14 times if you don't answer it now. I saw what you did to Michael Howard. We liked Michael Howard a lot.
Francis, which product took a bit of a body blow after failing to scrub up?
Anita Roddick of the Body Shop gave a talk plugging her new book and blew it. I mean, she admitted that most facial cosmetics are useless except for moisturisers. She said that in Tahiti, I think, the people who live there have the most perfect velvety complexions because they rub lumps of lard all over themselves, and that's all you need. She said everything else is useless. You'd be better off buying a bottle of wine and then rubbing all that over your face so you get that new just drunk feel and smell about you. And this from the woman who made her fortune from Lapsang Souchong neck gel and avocado and basil face scrub, which she now admits, apparently, allegedly, is rubbish.
We're all on the programme. We're just getting to that age where you see the Oil of Ulay adverts and think, oh, that looks like good stuff. That time in life when you wake in the morning and you think you've gone blind in one eye and it's just your top lip is folded across your face.
Before we start the final round, here's a cutting from The Guardian.
If any passenger has cause for complaint against a taxi driver, then they should contact the Hackney Carnage Licensing Office.
Thanks once again to our old friend Ted Shepherd of Thelwall for that. Jeremy, whose claims for eternity didn't ring true?
Whose claims? Someone who died? I don't know. Do you know, Andy? Whose claims for eternity didn't ring true?
It's not an insurance story.
Francis knows, I think.
Andy knows.
No, it's not the insurance story.
It's Francis, not it's vaguely insurance related. It's to do with a man called the Honourable Christopher Monckton.
It is.
Who was formerly Mrs. Thatcher's policy advisor when she was Prime Minister, and then went to better himself by devising an unsolvable jigsaw, and he was so confident it was unsolvable, called Eternity, that he said, I'll pay £1 million to anyone who solves it, which I think three people now have. And he's having to sell his castle in Scotland, send his wife into slavery and all the rest of it, send his children up chimneys, because he's hoisted by his own jigsaw. Poor chap. Well, I say poor chap. I mean, he's a blithering idiot. He's off his rocker. But...
Surely if you wanted to create an insoluble jigsaw, you just not put all the pieces in the box.
Inventor Christopher Monckton's fiendishly difficult eternity jigsaw puzzle was solved in a less than eternal 12 months. He said he was amazed at the speed with which the puzzle had been solved, though he did admit later perhaps it was a bad idea to put the solution on the inside of the lid. Tony, who should have known that drinking the water was da-da-da-dum?
Ah, it's a very good musical clue. Well done. It's American scientists this time. They've just clearly got nothing to do. They just sort of think, what do we do this week? I know Beethoven, who died in 1827. Let's give him a bit of another autopsy. And they got some hairs of his that were presumably sent to them. And they started studying this to try and work out more about Beethoven, and they decided that he had lead poisoning or something like that through looking at these hairs. A thing called, and they said he had a thing called plumism, which I thought meant you're addicted to plumbing. It explains the unfinished symphony because he just packed up doing it and went and fixed a ballcock and lagged some pipe. But what difference does it make when you listen to Beethoven now? You think, oh yes, that's a nice passage. And he had lead poisoning. Possibly.
Analysis of Beethoven's hair by a team at the Health Research Institute of Naperville, Illinois, has revealed that the composer's lifelong illnesses and personality disorders were possibly due to lead poisoning caused by lead in his water. Francis, why were letters for one North Yorkshire family being delivered via barking this week?
Oh, it's that North Yorkshire dog story. you read it, didn't you? Yeah, you read it.
Is it the one about the dog that could to deliver its letter?
Yes, it's a
touching,
it's a
very touching Grey Friars Bobby type story about a devoted dog which already I think collects the papers and does this and the other and now delivers the post as well.
But brilliantly, what they discovered was that the dog distributes different letters to the correct people in the household, whatever.
All dogs can read. That's how guide dogs know where they're allowed in. They could probably learn to lick the envelopes if they made a glue that tasted of dog's testicles. or lavatory bowls or something. You know.
Oh, you've spotted a gap in the market there, yeah. Jeremy. give Anita Roddick a ring, I'm sure.
It's plainly not true, is it?
No, it's cobbling.
They've tried to get on You've Been Framed, and they've tried tripping their kid down the stairs. they've, you know, put tripwire all around the fish pool. She hasn't had any accidents. They can't get on the programme. They thought, I know what we'll do. We'll lie about the dog. We'll get the kid to dress up in a dog costume.
We'll cover the kid in aniseed so the dog takes the letter to the kid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they probably take an article of clothing and put it in each envelope, and it's all done by smell. See? Ah, you see. We've solved this in no time, because you see, if we, when we all pull together, we get there in no time, don't we?
The multi-talented dog, Denver, a cocker spaniel, has also learned to do the shopping, fill the washing machine, collect the newspapers and use the phone. His owner said that if she could only teach him to eat food straight from the tin, fart loudly and leave puddles on the toilet floor, he'd be a complete replacement for her husband. Dog's efficiency was called into question when it was revealed that he'd recently delivered an Enigma machine to Jeremy Paxman. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along. Andy.
Right, this was very kindly sent in by Anne Bennett of Sheffield. Burglars who found a bag of powder during a break-in in Chadwell Heath, Essex, thought it was cocaine and tried to snort the contents. The bag marked Charlie did not contain a drug, but the ashes of a dead dog. The owner, Dee Blythe, said, "It was horrible knowing they were in my house. But the idea of them trying to get high on a dog certainly made me feel a bit better."
Tony.
This was sent in by an Austin Barrick, who was in a Bangkok hotel, for reasons that we don't really need to go into here. And he, amongst the signs he found on the door, those don't disturb and breakfast cards or whatever, there was one that said, "For instant maid service, hang on your knob."
This is from the Daily Mail of a couple of weeks ago when we were doing the show from Bournemouth. It's about Mrs. Haig. "The blossoming of Fionn has been building up all week at the Bournemouth conference. On Tuesday, she watched her husband perform his question and answer session in a grey tweed suit and black stiletto heels."
Thank you all. Now let's look at the final scores. Andy and Jeremy have 16 points, but this week's winners of the fully fitted caravan are Francis and Tony with 18 points. And before we leave you, here's an item from the Manchester Evening News.
Investigators are trying to determine the cause of a blaze that swept through a fire extinguisher factory in Greater Manchester.
Goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Andy Hamilton, Jeremy Hardy, Francis Ween and Tony Hawkes. The chairman was Simon Hoggart and the news was read by me, Corrie Caulfield. The chairman's script was written by George Poles, Nev Fountain, Debbie Barham and Simon Littlefield. And the producer was Lucy Armitage.